We're recording.
The pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
No, so I don't see any earphones, which I was looking for.
To receive right in compliance with the open public meeting law, is provided the date, time, and location of this meeting to at least two designated newspapers, published the same in the Asbury Press, the official newspaper, filed it with the clerk and posted notice on the bulletin board in the borough offices.
Is there volume?
Apparently.
Here.
Put it on mute.
But then I want to be able to actually record.
Fix us up.
There goes.
Okay, how are we doing?
Yeah, we don't have headphones to see if it's still recording, right?
No, but I think if it's green, well, here.
No, no, yeah.
Right, I can always say, yes.
Okay.
Okay.
And if it's not, do that.
That's it. Okay.
Cashmore, not here. Cunningham, here. DiGiulio?
Here.
DeSeo?
Here.
Duffy?
Here.
Lexstein?
Here.
Long? Not. Smith?
Here.
McGinley, not here. Bills?
Here.
Ms. Bills? Ray? Ray? Ray.
Here.
Okay, excellent.
Onto the board secretary appointment.
I'll make a motion to appoint Candace Mitchell as the board secretary for the second of the year.
A second, I agree with it all myself. We'll have a roll call. Cunningham, yes. DiGiulio?
Yes.
DeSeo?
Yes.
Duffy?
Yes.
Lexstein?
Yes.
Not here. Smith?
Yes.
Bills?
Yes.
Ray?
Yes.
Sorry, I had to drop lines.
Without his reading glasses.
Right, I'm doing pretty good.
You are.
Memorialization of the resolution for granting extension to the approval of Macau Ventures LLC.
Right, that's the 14 East New Street. It was under Tyler Nine, I think, originally.
Originally Tyler Nine, and was in the court process, and they've dropped the court process, I believe.
Correct.
If I read that properly. Does anybody want to make a motion or have discussion about that?
I'll make a motion to approve.
I'll second.
Cunningham, yes. DiGiulio?
Yes.
DeSeo?
Yes.
Duffy?
Yes.
Lexstein?
Abstain, given the G.
Okay. Smith?
Yes.
Bills?
Yes.
Ray?
Yes.
Motion carries.
And
let the record show that our famed Bob Knott has not failed us tonight. And
he's had a long commute.
I had a real long commute all the way to South Street.
No umbrella?
Oh, no, right there.
Okay. I guess you're wondering why we gathered here tonight. Right? When is what, did you say?
Last May.
Right, yeah. Is there any answer, Martha?
That's my answer, last May.
So as a result of there have been a number of recent cases of by people challenging planning and zoning boards, alleging their civil rights were violated by board members, by the actions of board members, that type of thing. Our our being C. Wright Municipal Excess Liability Joint Insurance Fund, which is you have your joint insurance fund, which covers basic, and then we have an excess for like an umbrella type policy. They have asked that all board members kind of receive some education on personal liability, what you can and can't do, those types of things. So it's not really a land use type of seminar, but more so actions and that type of thing. And they're just trying to prevent, you know, claims against the board for things that they do, like Facebook posts. Everyone talking.
John did that.
Yeah, talking to people outside of the board, talking to applicants, having, you know, if there are site visits, discussing the particular application with parties, those types of things. And again, generally speaking, board members are pretty much immune from most types of liability. And really, any appeal of your action is generally trying to overturn whatever your decision had been. And it's not a monetary type of lawsuit, as if you were sued for defamation or something else. So you can all be happy about that. And also you're covered, you know, by your excess insurance fund, but they do want you to listen up and do this. So it's part of a program to acquaint local officials with risk management principles designed to provide a general understanding of the legal principles pertaining to government operations. Because most of you are volunteers, well, all of you are volunteers. Some of you are also elected officials and have been elected officials in the past. So you have a probably a different perspective than some who are just coming on. This is your only, you know, dabble, so to speak, into local government. So again, most applicants who've been denied approval don't sue for monetary damages. They sue to overturn the decision of the board. Delays in winning approvals are usually a normal part of that process. They don't give rise to liability. So, for instance, if you took a restaurant that was seeking to reopen and it was delayed, they couldn't sue for their lost profits, that type of thing. So that's kind of what they're talking about. Even Mount Laurel cases generally don't have monetary type of relief. It's just injunctive relief and specific performance type of relief. Court orders requiring a town and board to take particular action, which most of you are familiar with the Gators property down there, that, you know, you were required to, you know, allow certain types of development. We generally, with the town and the board, negotiated down, you know, from what they originally wanted. You could do that, but that's the type of relief that generally comes about in terms of boards being sued. The reason land use disputes rarely become liability claims against municipalities because there's broad immunity granted to government decision makers, both the elected officials and boards like you. So land use is a judicial function. So we're kind of a quasi-judicial function, basically. You have the same broad immunities as a court would, judges, fact finders. Individual members of land use boards have the same protections from lawsuit that judges do. So because you're the fact finders, you're there, you have the same type of immunity that a judge would have. However, they don't apply when land use board and board members violate civil rights. So the starting point is the Fifth Amendment, which is beyond, you know, you have the right to remain silent type of thing. It provides that private property shall not be taken for public use without compensation. So we all know that people have sued by saying your zoning may be a taking by way of inverse condemnation, that you've zoned it into utility. We've talked about that with certain use variances. When you've seen it, you say, well, listen, that something has to be allowed on a particular piece of property. It may be undersized, you know, et cetera, but we can't zone it into utility. And so when a government entity does condemn private property for public use, then you have to pay for it. So an inverse condemnation claim would involve money in that they said, yes, the property was taken by way of zoning, then the town would be responsible for paying for whatever the loss was. Individual board members aren't held, you'd be happy to know, personally liable to pay whatever it is. Even if you as the planning board makes recommendations as to master plan and zoning ordinances that talk about certain things, that you're still protected under those. In long ago, in 1922, the Supreme Court extended the principle to that inverse condemnation that we were talking about, where government regulations, including your zoning, your master plan, sometimes you can have other smart growth plans, you can have environmental rules, shade tree regulations. A lot of towns have a lot of, they have an environmental commission, all those things. If it significantly diminishes the value of the property, then that could be an inverse condemnation that we were talking about before. Even though the town might not take ownership of the property like we would when we talked about the redevelopment process and condemning that we could take certain properties by way of eminent domain, you wouldn't own the property. But if you've zoned it into utility or you put such regulations on it, then that's an inverse condemnation. So in exactly, or you've diminished the value greatly. And they're not entitled to the highest and best use, by the way. So you can still zone. And just because the zoning changed, it might not be worth what it was worth when they could put 150 condos on it. That doesn't necessarily mean it's an inverse condemnation.
They also have to prove you weren't zoning for the your zoning. When you zone it for the better good, they have to prove that you were zoning them out.
True. But sometimes there are cases where properties get caught in that gap, you know, when you zone in it, because you're not looking at each individual lot when you zone. Basically, you're looking at regions, zones, areas, and sometimes there could be a lot that's going to get caught that, you know, is adversely affected. That's where zoning boards come in to give relief from that. And if they don't give relief, then it could be deemed, possibly deemed inverse condemnation. In utility, it means if you zone it so much, it's so restrictive that I can't use it for anything, then it's worthless or worth considerably less. I could, oh, great, thanks, I can use it for a park or an open space. Well, yeah. You know, that's, so when I say they're not entitled to the highest and best use, that's true, but you also can't, you know, give them basically nothing. You know, every case, obviously, you have to look at individually, but that's the
general. They have to make it a case.
They do. Yep. So nobody has the right to use their property in such a way that it'll threaten public safety, becomes it's a noxious or obnoxious use, that it materially impairs the rights of adjacent property owners. On the other hand, the government doesn't have the right to adopt regulations that effectively prohibit any reasonable use of private property. And when I say any, so again, you don't have to give them exactly what they want. If there's a reasonable use, if you've zoned, you know, a certain area as X, and that's a reasonable use of that property there, then even though it's not the hotel zone that they wanted or something else, you'd probably still be sustained, or your zoning would be sustained for the most part. You know, then we get into, which we don't really need to, but the whole spot zoning. So again, if you looked at one area, and we've talked about this in terms of our master plan, you know, if you look at, oh, let's look at Seabright right now and see what developable land do we have. Okay, we have these little things. Let's just zone every one of them X, which would make it very difficult to develop or be very restrictive. Well, you might be crossing a line. You have to be careful that that's spot zoning, because now you're looking at individual lots and trying to prevent them from being developed to whatever. However, if you're looking at a developable piece of property that's in a zone where there are large lots, and you're perfectly right to say, no, you have to, can only have large lots. You can't, you know, have intense use on that property. We all know the, you know, commercial residential type mix. So again, it's a fine line. Again,
this board's been very good about that.
Yeah. The board always has been in the town. I mean, the town does the zoning ordinances. The board reviews and approves them and gives their recommendations back.
We questioned a lot of changes and eventually agreed. And
right.
This board has been pretty good about it.
A lot of cases, and I actually went to the Supreme Court of this great state of New Jersey here a couple of years ago on the sex trade, you know, so to speak. And that's, they've received a lot of litigation over, you know, having the adult bookstore, the go-go bars, you know, that type of thing, what can be permitted. And it's a fine line because you also have something that's not unconstitutional per se, but it's unconstitutional as applied. So you could put restrictions on, say, a go-go bar, nude live dancing, all that type of thing, that it can't be within, you know, 1,000 feet of a school, a church, you know, that kind of thing. But if you do that, and then that really means there is not one single place in town where that could be, then that would probably run, that would be unconstitutional as applied because there's no way in your town they could do it. However, that my case said, you shouldn't look at the municipal boundaries, as long as they could have it within a reasonable proximity and that there are areas where they could put it, it doesn't have to be per town. And it actually worked. We won the battle but lost the war on that one, but, you know, it's... Yeah, Sayreville is like the king. You know, they had all those up there in Sayreville, I can't even remember the names of them all, but they still have a lot, and they still have a lot of litigation going on about them. But so, you know, that's like the, you know, the not in my backyard type of cases. You know, I'm not going to allow any of this in my backyard. You can't put it here. You know, you can put it, you know, in Rumson. That's fine. You know,
actually had it way, way, way back when. We had somebody wanted to put a massage place in Seabright. Do you remember that? I forget how that was dealt with.
And you know, like we laugh because it's, you know, massage places in quotes, but that's now a very legitimate business. I mean, people are, yeah, I'm right. I mean, they're not only, yeah, exactly. Hand and Stone, all those are very legitimate businesses and all. It's just, you know, they have a bad reputation.
It was interesting at the time. To watch a board,
yes,
have all kinds of dynamics about it.
Oh, sure.
In this town kind of
right.
Stuff.
Yep.
And it was, I think we handled it well. I forget what we did.
We're going to do that now. I see all this stuff going in the papers about all these towns now allowing marijuana.
Yes, but the statute allowed them to do that, so that's a difference. So the statute that created the will create the right to legally sell marijuana gave the towns the right to decide whether they wanted to or not. You know, so that's it is. Yeah. Right. Right. But the federal government, especially and state, right. They've really given protection to these unpopular type of uses. And it's mostly the, you know, nude dancing places and that type of thing. Massages and whatnot. And what happens, the issue with them is when you lose, there's a fee shifting. So that if you lose and you've deprived them of that and you lose, you're paying their attorney's fees. Doesn't always happen, but it certainly.
I saw too, I don't know if it was Eaton Town or Shrewsbury. Well, it's happened. They were trying to get
Right. Yeah, tattoo parlors are some of those. Like I said, the adult bookstores, the vape, right. So, yep. Right, correct. Right. Right. Yep. Right, and in fee shifting, you're paying whatever their reasonable fee is, which is always outrageous, to be honest with you. I mean, although if they have, it's supposed to be, you know, based on what their retainer agreement is, you know, so everybody, if they are taking a case that they think is going to be in fee shifting, then you're saying, oh, my fee is, you know, $400 an hour. Whereas if you lose it, you're probably only going to charge the client $250 an hour, whatever it is, but they jack it up just so they can submit a certification to the court. But I mean, that's just the cynic in me that says that. but you know, it seems to be. But even they say, as a result, plaintiff attorneys often build up the number of hours if they believe they have a good chance of winning. It's not unusual for the plaintiff's attorney to be awarded an amount far higher than the plaintiff themselves. So there's also been a lot of litigation, and it's ongoing now, even Lakewood. Jackson, Howell are all having this with the Religious Land Use and the Institutionalized Persons Act. So a mosque was awarded damages of $7.5 million, including $5 million for the mosque's attorneys. It was adopted by Congress in 2000. That act basically says that no government shall impose land use regulation that creates a substantial burden on religious exercise unless in furtherance of a compelling governmental interest that is the least restrictive way of accomplishing that objective. This really isn't going to concern you guys a lot because you're not the ones that are zoning. You're not creating the zones. The Mr. Lexine here is the one that's going to be holding the bag on that one.
Somebody mentioned it this year.
Yes, we did. Right. They're very controversial. There's absolutely fee shifting on those types of cases. If you've seen, like, Howell has been under the gun lately because they're trying to zone because they feel, and this is coming from the press and not my statement, but Lakewood is, you know, expanding its borders into our town and we don't want it. Right. So Jackson also. So there's a lot of that there, you know, but well, no, and the, they think they can, but you know, they're losing mostly. Sayreville
kind of left them.
Yeah. Sayreville. Right. That's right. Exactly.
They go beyond the board.
They do.
And they use Facebook posts. And yep. They're admissible.
Yeah.
The board never said anything.
Right.
And I find that incredibly unfair.
It is.
That a bunch of wacky citizens who post obnoxious racist stuff
yes.
on Facebook, the town gets held responsible.
It's Exhibit A.
It's insane. That's crazy.
Right.
That's crazy. And that's the only type of case where they allow that.
Right.
Any other case in the entire, any other type of case, they can't bring in outside comments. It's only what's in the record. Or for this
right.
type of case, they can bring in outside comments.
Yep.
That never appeared in the record whatsoever.
For religious cases?
Yeah.
Right.
Religious discrimination.
So usually if you see, right, it is. And if you see, and the institutionalized persons case, methadone clinics, those are the same types of things that, you know, you will see, you will never see a neighborhood go as crazy as it will go. Unless
that's
you,
going on in Hollywood right now. Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, people lose their minds.
A year and a half, 2 years ago, Thompson, right across the bridge.
Yep.
Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, so.
And the people don't get it. People don't understand they're hurting their own causes.
They do not get it.
They don't get it. I've tried to tell people in the past, it's like, shut up. You know, and when they come to complain.
Well, everybody should shut up on Facebook anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
Not about zoning. You know, they just don't get it.
I try to tell.
Look at the happy pictures of the kids.
Yeah. That's it. See the grandbabies, puppies.
My great nephew in Australia.
That's
what I have it for.
And puppies.
And all the political.
Oh, yeah.
This is the worst. As attorney to the public, it's like, you do realize there's a record being developed.
Yeah. And I try to, when I see towns that have controversies and you see, you know, the public with their Facebook posts, I try to get the council people, the board, whatever it may be at every time to say, we understand and that we have not read these. We are not reading them. They do not influence us. I mean, you really have to go out, you know, and
create the opposite.
You do. You have to be affirmative. Well, listen, again, we want to see the grandnephew in Australia. So that I wouldn't say.
Theoretically, I was wondering how that would work. Like, nobody in the planning board has Facebook.
It would. Yeah. And you know, again, if the public is so, if they come, even if people are coming to your meetings like they did with the Mad Hatter and they're screaming this, that, and the other thing. I mean, they impute a certain amount of that.
Well, that came up.
Oh, yeah. That influence, sure. Right, to
John and
to your decision making. Yeah. I mean, right. You can't, but I will say to you specifically, right, only look at the grandnephew in Australia, puppies, you know, those types of things, new babies. Don't make comments about anything going on town, on your board, you know, any of that. It will only come back to bite you and the board and the town. But it's very true. And the vitriol is, you know, just ridiculous. I mean, people get very incensed over it. No. Oh, there's an anonymity that, you know. Right. That, exactly. Exactly. So I jumped the gun. Another example of these cases concerns adult bookstores and movie theaters. First Amendment, government can't regulate the content of speech, but can regulate the side effects. In some cases, you just have to be very careful. Shod versus Mount Ephraim, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a zoning ordinance that prohibited adult bookstores and theaters because the zoning ordinance allowed a broad range of other uses in its commercial zone. So the court said you can't single out a particular type of speech as objectionable as it is. And that's, again, where it might not be, you know, unconstitutional per se, but it's unconstitutional as applied. So, you know, you might allow, again, you might say, okay, well, we'll allow adult bookstores, you know, provided they have at least 20,000 square feet. And, you know, when you're making the regulations such that it almost prohibits them, and then as it's applied, you know, because you're entitled certainly to regulate certain things and to have uses in the proper places. You don't
have 20 parking spaces.
That's it. You know, you don't want the nuclear reactors next to the, you know, the hospital or whatever, you know, or the nursing home. But so you can zone, but you just have to, you know, do it fairly and equitably.
So we could not say I don't feel that marijuana dispensary would be in the best interest for Seabright. Therefore,
you can don't use that, because that's by statute Seabright can do that.
That's one way.
Right, but say it's an adult bookstore instead. Okay. Use the
or an adult bookstore.
Right.
There's really not a statute yet. Right?
Well, yeah, right. It's written. It's just not passed. Okay. Right. Yeah.
You're working.
You're working on
right.
That one. But let's say an adult bookstore. We could not say, you know, I don't feel that's a good thing for the town of Seabright, so I'm going to vote against it.
Well, it would be a use variance, because we don't permit them.
Right.
So they would have you'd have to show that it has a negative impact on the surrounding community. So they are they're not permitted. And by
okay.
So therefore they would have to be
there's a list of permitted uses.
Okay.
You're not one of them.
Right.
How old is this?
Well, it's your zoning ordinance. It's not a list. It's your zoning ordinance.
And it's been updated.
Yeah.
Updated over time.
Just updated last year.
Right. Now, Renton.
Well, we're working on the new ordinance.
Yeah.
Updated master plan.
Right. Renton is probably the biggest U.S. Supreme Court case on this adult bookstore, movie theater, whatever it was, go-go bar thing, and that's what I was talking about. It did say that you can't have, you know, adult, whatever it was, movie theater within 1,000 feet of a residential zone. And when the town does that, they always have to give certain reasons. And so they showed there's a higher crime rate in and around this type of use. There's more, you know, whatever it is, more likelihood of the, so they did that and they showed it was right. You probably have a harder time in Seabright because, you know, we only have 1,000 feet in Seabright now because you're much smaller and, you know, you can't throw a stone. You know, I mean, really, you could throw a stone from one side anyway to the other, maybe not one end to the other. So you again, when you're zoning and when you're making these regulations, you really have to look at, by that regulation, am I effectively saying, well, you can't really build anywhere in town this type of use, because it couldn't happen, you know, if you put so many restrictions on it.
I'm not expecting anybody to know this, but where is the nearest adult? Is it the Long Branch happen?
Well, isn't there still one on?
There's one in 35.
35, yeah.
Yeah.
That go-go bar? Yeah, Eatontown.
The Eatontown go-go bar.
By Seaview Square, right?
The go-go bar.
Yeah, the go-go bar? Oh, that's gone? What was the name of that? Something.
The one on 35 is gone, the Cabaret.
Cabaret? There was another one there, too. I got a lot of clients out of that.
Heartbreakers,
that's it.
I know that. I know Red Bank.
Yes.
Red Bank has a zone red light district along the Michigan River, I believe.
Right.
I think it still is.
Yeah. Because it's not near any residential. Right. They don't care. I mean,
what road is it on?
Newman Springs.
I believe the zone in Red Bank still out of heavy. Which is how a lot of towns get away.
And nobody can afford to get.
Right.
So.
Yeah, it's more the go-go bars and the.
But I think in-town still has it on 35.
The adult bookstores were big before pre-computers. Nobody can just download their porn.
Like a dental place.
Yeah, yeah. Is it gone now?
No, it's there.
It's gone.
It's there.
Next to the soccer place.
I thought it was still there.
Oh, wow.
I'll have to look there, it's not there.
I can stream it all now.
So the question is, it comes whether going to Carrie's point, whether a person would have access to it within a circumference. You know what the circumference is, how many miles, do you remember? Was that Tinnit Falls case, wasn't it?
Saraville.
Oh, it's Saraville. Remember how many miles?
It was. It was. I know I went across the state border because I went to Staten Island, so.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
You had to take a ferry across?
And Alvin said, why should we, I said, are you kidding? It's easier to get to Staten Island than it is to get to, you know, half of New Jersey on the other side. I mean, you know, from Saraville.
Right.
So, yeah.
Moving along.
Moving along. So there's a couple of cases you have to make the call. While considering a change in zoning law, the governing body expressed concern about the impact that a development would have on the town. The developer voluntarily offered to contribute $200,000 to offset some of those costs. There was no legal requirement for the developer to make their contribution. Is it legal for the governing body to accept that strictly voluntary contribution?
What does the developer want in exchange?
Well, he's looking to do a development. The town was worried that it's going to...
Which body to accept it?
Governing body.
Oh, yes. In special ways. Not this board.
No. So what they're saying is, say he was going to build a high rise, and the town said, well, we don't even have a hook and ladder. We couldn't even get to the sixth floor if it would burn down. He said, I'll give you $200,000 for a hook and ladder. Can the town do it? Yeah, or if the town says, oh, you know what, we need to widen the road because we can't fit the number of people here. Well, the answer is no, so don't jump too far ahead.
Make a contribution for this park?
No.
No. So.
We took those condos down?
If there's a legal requirement, yeah, but you might have. No. No, and by the way, you're for multi.
We make it every quarter.
And for a multi-family type of.
Every quarter to take that.
Right.
I know what Dave's talking about, and it's not.
You know what I'm talking about.
And by the way, though, but Dave, for multi-family, your zoning ordinance requires they provide recreation. So in lieu of that, you could take a contribution. So if there's a legal requirement, so if you have a multi-family of. I don't remember what we have, say 10 or more, 5 or more units, you have to provide some type of recreation for those residents. We had that with the school. And, right, so, and they said, well, you know, there's no room here, we'll give you money to add on to your tot lot or whatever you have over here. That you can do. But absent a legal requirement, voluntary contributions are equal to pay to play. So it's where favorable land use decisions will go to basically the highest bidder. I'm going to pay you to give me the okay to do it. Correct. Well, because it might have, right, off-site requirements. So a lot of ordinances, like the one I just mentioned on ours, will require some off-site improvements. So that could be traffic signalization, that type of thing. If it... No, because it's a legal requirement. So under your ordinance, say, if you said, say the ordinance says any increase in traffic of, you know, 35 trips per whatever, you know, making it up hour is going to require an extra lane of travel or something, then you can require a contribution for that, or you can accept a contribution. But if, like I said, if they want to build a high rise, and the town says, oh, I don't know, we don't have a, you know, a hook and ladder, or a road can't take it, or the blah, blah, blah. And they say, oh, we'll pay for it. You can't do that because you don't have an underlying requirement that.
You can take it after the meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing to stop you from donating the.
No, that's correct. Absolutely.
The application there, we were considering.
The road widening?
We're going to allow them to do that. They had to widen the road.
Yes.
They widen the road to get their
application. But there's a requirement to widen the road there because you're. No, there was. No, well, you gave them a waiver. Yeah, you had to get a, give a waiver for that. You have a requirement that your roads are 20 foot and they were 16 or whatever it was, so. All right. Yeah, and actually, most towns have a volunteer fire department, so, but that's. Right, and you know what, because it's a fire department, I used the wrong example here, because you're a volunteer and they could probably do that, because it's not town owned, but, you know, who knows. All right, second case, members of land use board visited the site of an application and engaged in a discussion with both the applicant and objectors. While most of the discussion was limited to specifics of the application, one of the members went beyond and engaged in a heated dialogue with one of the parties. This member was recused from further deliberations. Is it legal for the other members of the board who were at that site meeting to continue in the proceeding? So.
I didn't know you had all were allowed to have a site meeting.
Sure you are. If you can always go down and look at it. Yeah, you know, because a lot of times. Yeah, you can even have, you can go and say, show me exactly where on the property this is and that is, and you, here's the plan. You know, you're a small town and you know most of your properties, you know, and you're bigger towns and all.
You just can't create a meeting out in the field.
Right. Correct. So if Dave gets into a heated discussion, because, you know, he'd be the one who has a fight with somebody, objector or otherwise, screaming about why it's right or wrong or up and good and bad and all that, then I disqualify him because he's already, you know, tainted himself. The rest of you were at that meeting. You can still continue or you can't. There you go.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Yes, sir. Recusal of one member who engaged in that heated discussion was an adequate cure in that case. That was Smith versus Fairhaven. The court reiterated that discussions at site meetings must not go beyond the arguments and allegations advanced during the course of the board's meetings. I go further than that. If you go visit a site, the discussion should only be a question of, show me where, here's the plan, show me where's X, show me where's Y. Don't listen to arguments, don't get into, you know, well, I think it should be this. Ask questions, and as Bob just said, just the facts, ma'am.
And then,
let's say,
Dave.
In the situation.
Yes.
And I said, yeah, he's right.
Then I'd disqualify you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're
you can say, why don't you tell me what it is you want to do here?
Right, that,
you,
exactly.
You can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you should disclose if you do that on the record.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Went to the site and asked them what they wanted to do, and I'm sure they're going to continue that conversation.
It's just
another
site.
Board members aren't allowed
to. Right.
Two board members can't talk privately.
No, they should not. Correct. And by the way, as Mark just said, if you do have that site visit and you talk and you do it, you should put it on the record when you come in and say, hey, I drove by or I stopped by, I looked at it. You know, I walked down to that bulkhead and it's falling in, or that you should put that on the record, that you made observations or you had a discussion, whatever it is, you should put that on the record.
That's good practice,
actually. It is.
I never talk to anybody.
Right. And that's how most people, yeah.
Usually you have to explain what you're doing on somebody's property or next to it.
Yeah, somebody comes down.
But that's okay. Yeah,
with a shotgun.
I'm on the planning zoning board. And I wanted to understand what your site looked like.
So every time we come to that meeting, when we look at the site, even if the owner's not there, we should tell you that we went.
Yeah, I mean, you should always just say, you know, and I can ask in the beginning, did anybody, you can just say, I drove by, I walked down. Yeah. And, you know, most people do, like Dave will always say, you know, I took a ride by down there, or Lance says it often. Yeah, and Lance will always say that, you know, hey, I took a walk down there and I looked at it and, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's all you have to say. You don't have to, right. You don't have to go into any detail. No, no, no.
And there were 17 neighbors screaming at me.
Right. Right. Yeah, and that's, then I wouldn't even worry about. And again, the reason that you are, well, one of the reasons, I should say, one of the reasons that your decisions are given such deference is because you have a particular knowledge of your town. You know the properties, you know the area, you know what's next door, you know the history. So that's why courts, you know, give you a lot of deference in the decisions that you make, because you are familiar with it. they're not familiar with it. They can't say, oh my gosh, that lot's been vacant and it's been an eyesore. Or, you know, I mean, they don't know that. They don't know what you know. They don't know that, you know, that gets flooding all the time and look what he's going to do. They're going to improve the drainage and this, that, and the other thing, you know. So you have particular knowledge of it, and you're entitled to that, and that's, you know. All right, next case. An experienced developer received a Superior Court order instructing the town to approve a project after considerable delay. The planning board then willfully ignored the court ruling and rejected the application anyway. The developer sued both the town and members of the planning board personally. The town settled out of court, and a jury found three members personally liable, awarding damages of $5,000 each. Question, will the discretionary immunity protect members of the planning board personally from the punitive damages, even if they willfully ignored the order of the court to approve the application? So it's, are you going to be covered by your excess liability? I'm going to make it easy for you on this one. Yes. Yes, you are, because, and you'll be happy. Because they say, we think that the public interest requires that persons serving on planning boards act with independence and without fear that developers will bring them into court. As a result, members of the board were personally immune, but the town itself would still be liable for their actions. Right. So the town would pay your $5,000, or the town's insurance company would pay your $5,000.
Has that ever happened in this town?
Not in this town that I know of. Oh, yeah. Well, Gators, kind of. I mean, that's some parts of it, you know, I mean.
Well, that was a little more complicated because it was, of yeah, issues.
Yeah, it was a builder's remedy with Gators, but then they came in and changed it. And so, I mean, we approved, but we didn't give them everything they wanted. And then they did sue, but then we came to an agreement. So it never got to that.
It wasn't exactly
right.
And I mean, the court could just tell you. If the court tells you to approve,
you should do it.
Approve it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't care what that says, because I think if a judge wanted to find you, they'll figure out ways.
Well, they did fine her.
They fined the town.
Yeah. No, they fined the individuals. They just didn't have to pay the insured. But yeah, I mean, really? It, you know, not, we had this discussion with Gators. We did deny the part, that second application or third. I forget how it went.
I still think we would have upheld.
I think we would have, and that's because, although the builder's remedy, they said you're entitled to the 24 units and all, you as a board had a right to say, okay, but that marina commercial use, that's not part of that, and we wanted it tied to the residential and that, and the parking across the street. So I think you would have been upheld on that too. There were rights.
It's really the access to across the street.
That's all it was. It was the access across.
It was the access across the street, and what was also the marina. Because
all of that was triggering the
right. What?
Right. Approval.
We got approval. They got approval.
Without the parking across the street.
Right. Okay. And the fourth case.
It looks like they're starting them.
Yeah, they're apparently doing it.
All right. A religious institution applied for variances to build the school in a residential zone. A board member lived in a nearby development and coached her neighbors on what questions they should ask at the hearing. She did not recuse from the deliberations. So she wasn't within 200 feet, but she was in a nearby neighborhood, so she wouldn't automatically be recused. But she coached the objectors and neighbors on what to say and how to object, because she had, you know, she was a board member and knew what to do. So it was the board member who helped the residents draft their objections entitled to personal immunity. Very good. No, absolute immunity does not extend to actions of officials taken either in bad faith, although I think ignoring the court order is bad faith.
It doesn't make any sense.
No, because of corruption or primarily in furtherance of personal instead of public interest. So in the other one, they felt that the board thought it was a bad development, that being shoved down their throat by some stupid judge, and that wasn't in the public interest. In this one, it was her personal interest that she was promoting. I agree. I don't agree with all of these. Right. Right. So, yeah. But so again, if you
are they asking for a copy of the tape?
No. So
I would not be surprised.
Here, some other examples of where immunity did not apply because of bad faith. During a close re-election campaign, we know this, the mayor asked all members of the planning board from his party to vote against a controversial application. Now, shockingly, it's illegal to influence decisions for political or personal gain. The phone calls cost the taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the
Was the mayor participating in the application?
No, but the mayor appoints the planning board members. The mayor said to members of his political party, vote against this, vote against this, vote against this, vote against this. And they ruled that that obviously was bad faith and it was tampering. Exactly, pretty much, right, obstructing. In another example, a developer submitted a conforming, a conforming application to build a commercial building that included a daycare center. The mayor forced the developer to scale back the application, but still voted against it. Subsequently, it came to light that the mayor had an interest in another daycare center nearby.
We don't even need to keep going.
Well, conflicts of interest are tricky. For example, during the hearing on a case involving the application to build a senior citizen home, the mayor created a storm when he said that this might be a good place for his mother to live. In that other case, though, did the mayor's comment create a conflict of interest that required him to recuse? So about the one where he said, oh, this might be a nice place for my mother to live. No, that did not. Right. The mayor didn't have a conflict merely because his mother, you know, he said, hey, it's a nice place for, you know, place like my mom. However, the mayor was also a board member of a church adjacent to the proposed senior center. And therefore, the mayor's vote was a conflict because he had a relationship with the church. Potential conflicts must be taken seriously. In case six, a town purchased land for a parking lot. The mayor then entered into an agreement to lease some of the spaces for his business. Subsequently, the town advertised bids to pave the parking lot and awarded the bid. Before voting on the contract award, the mayor was advised by the municipal attorney that his vote on the award was not a conflict of interest, even though his business would be using many of the spaces. Hopefully he was fired soon. A complaint was made to the local finance board, which fined the mayor $200 after deciding the mayor's actions were clearly over the line. The mayor appealed, and the appellate court ruled that absent any indication of collusion, the fact that the mayor requested and received the advice of the municipal attorney qualified the mayor for the safe harbor defense. So to be eligible for that safe harbor defense, the advice has to be given. So if you ask me, can I vote on this? Over the years, I mean, a number of you have come to me and said, you know, I'm whatever interest is it. So the advice has to be given prior to your action, obviously, not after you've, you know, discussed and disclosed. The individual who offered the advice possessed the authority or responsibility, that would be like me or something. Simply relying on your personal attorney or a friend is not sufficient. So the individual seeking advice made full disclosure of all pertinent facts and circumstances. So if you give half the story, you might not be protected. And the individual complied with the advice, including any restrictions that may have been given. So that will provide you safe harbor. So if you say, you know, I'm a member of this church. I'm not on the board. I mean, I go to it, you know, sometimes I don't go every Sunday, you know, that type of thing. You know, do I have a conflict, you know, and you get advice and then it later comes out that, well, maybe you had a conflict. As long as you asked, and if I'm the one and I told you yes, no, or you don't have a conflict unless it gets to this stage and if, you know, blah, blah, blah. So you've got to follow whatever restrictions are given. Then you'll have a safe harbor. Let's see. The owner of an otherwise conforming lot in a single family zone was prevented from starting construction by DEP because of floodplain regulations. The DEP ruled that the property can only be used for open space, parkland, or parking lot. The owner sued, saying that this was inverse condemnation. Did the court rule that DEP's actions constituted a taking through inverse condemnation? I would sure hope so, by the way, but you know, you never know what the courts will do in this state. But yes, in this case, they did. They ruled that in deciding inverse condemnation cases, courts must ask if the regulation effectively eliminated all economically productive use of the land. So that's what I said in the beginning. After answering that question, the courts go further and determine if the regulation unduly interferes with legitimate investment-backed expectations of the property owner, depending on various factors. Based on that analysis, the court found inverse condemnation occurred in this case, and ultimately, the property owner sold the two lots to the town. Inverse condemnation cases are complicated and expensive to litigate. For example, the Highlands Water Protection and Planning Act effectively makes it very difficult to win approvals to develop develop in 9% of the state. However, in drafting the legislation, the state added a provision to the law that allows the Highlands Protection and Planning Commission to grant waivers to property owners who can demonstrate inverse condemnation. As a result, owners must go through the appeal process before they can go to court, and you know that could take years. So
it could essentially they're continuing the inverse
they're
condemnation.
They're screwed. Yes, pretty much.
They're continuing it.
$7 million, you know, and then closed on it, and then all of a sudden it was declared wetlands. And build on it.
Well,
every row, and so I don't know what happened with that.
We did a subdivision in Colts Neck years ago that got approvals for I forget how many lots, and they never finalized it. They didn't perfect everything, and the wetlands regulations have changed in the intervening years. So now the lot yield would be probably half of what their original approval was. That's probably not going to be an inverse condemnation because they're still entitled to develop their property, not as well as they wanted to, and they didn't perfect that subdivision. If they had perfected it and gone forward, it probably would have been protected. But you know, you'll see also.
Did he quit, John?
Patient.
It was just land.
Do you sue a realtor for selling something?
You sue everybody.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's it. And you know, part of it can be that the regulations change.
I know the regulations do change.
Right.
I bought lakefront property, and when by the time they declared all freshwater wetlands, the property was unbuildable because it was not large enough there.
Well, then you would, but you would be entitled to relief to build something on. If not, they would have to take that, but nonetheless. All right. A Muslim congregation proposed to build a conforming mosque and educational center on a site of a former hotel. Within 2 months, the council adopted a revised zoning code that required a church to seek conditional use variance if located in a residential zone. In one of the hearings, no less than 500 citizens attended and things became quite ugly. The town argued that the area in question had winding roads and there were other properties where mosques could locate, although these properties were substantially more expensive. The mosque argued that its consultant found that traffic would not be a problem and that the area already had educational and other similar uses. Did the court accept the town's position that it was not in violation of the Religious Land Use Institutional Persons Act because the mosque could locate on other properties? It's a Bridgewater. It was Bridgewater. So now the federal court.
It's a lot like the synagogue in the movie theater.
Yeah.
Long Ridge.
Yes. So I'll tell you that if the town hadn't rushed to change their zoning ordinance, it probably would have had a much better result. But the federal court kind of was moved by how quickly the council moved once they, you know, to change the zone. And the town ended up paying $2.5 million to purchase another property for the mosque. And the township's insurer paid the mosque's legal bills that amounted to $5 million. That's what I was saying about those lawyers.
Those mosque lawyers really go after it.
Yeah. All right. Zoning board conducted a hearing on a proposal to develop a mobile home park. Towards the end of the hearing, a resident spoke about a political controversy that was not relevant to the zoning issues before the board. He was asked to stop, and when he refused, a scuffle broke out between the resident and the board chairman. Democracy can be messy. At a hearing, can a land use board limit testimony to issues that are relevant to this decision before the board?
Yes.
Yeah, clearly.
Absolutely.
Yes. The most frequently cited case is White versus City of Norwalk. The federal court said in dealing with agenda items, the council does not violate the First Amendment when it restricts speakers to the subject at hand. While speakers cannot be stopped from speaking because the moderator disagrees with the viewpoint he's expressing, it certainly may stop him if his speech becomes irrelevant or repetitious. You can also put on reasonable time limits, that type of thing, which, you know, sometimes we do.
We've been very good about that.
Right.
We want everybody to get it out of their system.
Is it a repetitious thing applied to Gazarovski?
It should.
It did.
So interestingly, though,
tough on him at times.
Yeah, interestingly, now the council meetings have to have a public portion. They have to reserve a portion of the meetings for open comment. But really, the land use boards, there's not a requirement for that. But we always do it. I don't know. I refuse to know anything about school boards. Really, because it increases my blood pressure and I just can't do it. No. So a board hearing is not a speaker's corner in Hyde Park. By law, boards can limit comment to issues that are relevant to what the board may consider in reaching its decisions, can also insist on decorum consistent with its status as a court, which we've done. When the land use board allows a hearing to stray into inflammatory comments that are not relevant, then it risks opening the town to liability suit. And, you know, we've had that, and I think our chairman's been very effective in squashing the people that get out of line. You know, they recommend this, and I think maybe we'll add it to our little script. So their recommendation, I don't do it in anywhere, and I've never seen it done anywhere else, but their recommendation is that in addition to the Open Public Meeting Act that we say at the beginning, you know, of every meeting, they like to have a statement to the effect that this meeting is a judicial proceeding. Any questions or comments must be limited to the issues that are relevant to what the board may legally consider in reaching a decision, and decorum appropriate to a judicial hearing must be maintained. We've never needed it. I think I would reserve that to just if people started straying to say it. But
yeah, I think you could add that during the meeting.
Yeah, I don't. I think
hammer,
it's,
Dan, yeah. This is a judicial.
Yeah. That's
proceeding.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's almost offensive to your public to say it unless. Yeah, there you go. All right, last case. How are we doing? Perfect. A group of Orthodox Jewish residents attempted.
Actually, you got about 45 seconds.
All right. Attempted to create. Oh, this has been very big around here, too. They attempted to create an enclosed Eruv district or zone so they could push or carry objects outside their homes on the Sabbath. Eruvs were originally built with ropes on and wooden poles, but today an Eruv can be established by running plastic string between utility poles. Where this has been done, the string is high and out of sight. The utility company agreed, but after bitter controversy, the town decided to stop the plan by enforcing its 1954 ordinance that prohibits placing signs and the like on utility poles, fences, and other public places. Did the town violate the residents' civil rights by enforcing its sign ordinance to prevent the Eruv?
It's small one, right?
No, Deal. Well, Deal, it's Deal. Been everywhere. I had Long Branch, too. Long Branch, West Long Branch, Deal. They create an Eruv district because if you're an Orthodox Jew on the Sabbath, you can't go outside of your Eruv district.
Extended it with a line around the property.
Right. They can't like push carts or carry objects or anything unless they're within this protected zone.
Around the neighborhood.
Right.
No,
it's just the neighborhood.
Around the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. It's a big neighborhood.
They got the telephone company around the telephone.
No, it's bigger than a neighborhood, yeah. Even. It usually goes from where the synagogue is to where their neighborhood is, right? Like, you know, in that. Yeah. Now, some. No, they're way high up.
Can't they just imagine it?
Yeah.
Can't they just imagine where they're supposed to be?
Well, actually, I think it was in Long Branch or one of them, and I guess it depends on how Orthodox you are, and I don't claim to know. They had these little, whatever, like,